This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to announce the start of his presidential campaign this evening during a live audio conversation on Twitter with Elon Musk. But even with former President Donald Trump's mounting legal troubles, he's been keeping his lead in national polls of likely GOP primary voters. Which issues will draw voters to the polls later this year, and which factors will determine how they vote? Plus, negotiations over the debt ceiling continue, and Ohio has its own political battle raging over the effort to make it more difficult to amend the state's constitution. We've got plenty of political news to talk about today, and we have the full hour to dig into all of it. Joining me now to do just that are political journalist and host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin. Welcome back, Ken.
Thank you, Lucy.
And University of Cincinnati School of Public and International Affairs Associate Professor of Political Science, David Niven, Ph.D. Thanks for being here, David.
My pleasure.
The University of Cincinnati is a financial supporter of Cincinnati Public Radio. You can talk politics with us today by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk at wvxu.org. But before we dive into the 2024 presidential race, Ken, what trivia question do you have for us this month?
Well, Joe Biden, despite my predictions, did announce that he's going to seek re-election. I didn't think he would. But a poll showed that a majority of even Democrats feel he's too old to run again. And he'd be 86 years old when he finished his term, should he be reelected. And so therefore, some people are saying that maybe he should get a new running mate, given the fact, you know, he'd be 86 years old. And they're not confident that Kamala Harris is the right person to finish the job. But the trivia question is, when was the last time a president got rid of his elected vice president for another term?
That's a good one, Ken. If you think you know the answer, give us a call at 513-419-7100. We only take trivia guesses over the phone, and the winner will get a Cincinnati Edition political show button. Let's get right to our conversation. Ken, as I mentioned, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis is expected to announce his run for president today. Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina kicked off his presidential campaign Monday. What do you make of this crowded GOP field?
Well, as we saw in 2016, I think most people feel that the more candidates enter, and of course there may be more to come, Chris Christie is looking at it, Doug Burgum, you know who he is, of course, the very famous governor of North Dakota.
Thank you for clarifying.
Never heard of him. Yeah. But I mean, there are a lot of people who are running, and of course Mike Pence is considering it, blah, blah, blah. And so the feeling is the more candidates run, the better it helps Donald Trump, as we saw in 2016. And by the time it was like down to one challenger, maybe John Kasich, it was too late. Trump had the momentum and went on to win the nomination easily. So, look, you know, there are a lot of people who are looking at Donald Trump. They see a formidable lead in the polls for him, but they also know that he's under indictment and there could be other indictments falling in the case in Atlanta, in the case of the federal government, Department of Justice. So they feel that, well, you know, something, maybe he's a leader now in, you know, May and June of 2023. But by the time the primaries come around next winter, I guess, it could be a different story. So, you know, it's a formidable lead, but it's not, he doesn't seem unstoppable. And there are other candidates going on. And that's what Tim Scott was trying to talk about. He said, look, I have an optimistic life story. I have $22 million in the bank. I'm in an early primary state. And while he's not been a critic of Donald Trump, as some others have been, he has a certainly more of an optimistic message, clearly more so than Trump or Ron DeSantis, who, as you said, will announce his candidacy tonight with America's favorite game show host, Elon Musk.
Well, David, you know, as Ken just mentioned, former President Trump is still the front runner based on the polling I've seen. Have you seen anything that shows otherwise? I mean, the last polling I saw, he was north of 50% in national polls.
Well, I think clearly the polls are in Trump's camp right now. And, you know, there's a depth and a fervor among his supporters. You know, people don't tend to support Donald Trump lightly. And, you know, as Ken mentioned, that's really where the power of a big field, you know, comes in to help him. You know, there may be a group of Republicans out there who would never vote for Trump. But if you divide them between Haley and Scott and Pence and 10 other people,
Doug Burgum.
Yeah, exactly. and the governor of North Dakota, you really do dilute the power of any, you know, alternative to Trump. And you know, I think we saw this in Ohio in the 2022 U.S. Senate primary on the Republican side, where there's a big field of pro-Trump voices, and they competed for each other, you know, to see who could be the Trumpiest amongst them. And the one non-Trump voice, you know, in that case, State Senator Matt Dolan, you know, he polled, you know, roughly one fifth of the electorate. There's just not that many Republicans, you know, who really are ready for an alternative. And you certainly can't afford to divide them.
And one thing we have to be recognizing is that, yes, there are national polls, but really political junkies know that the real polls that matter are what's going on in Iowa, you know, New Hampshire, South Carolina, and Nevada, the first four states in the primary and caucus contests. So there's one poll. I think I've seen a second poll that showed DeSantis with a slight lead over Trump in New Hampshire. So what I'm saying is, yes, the national polls all do favor Trump, but let's pay attention to what those early state polls are showing, and that could be much different.
Ken, have you seen any other early state polls aside from the New Hampshire poll you just referenced?
I have not. And, you know, Iowa is notoriously difficult to poll. You know, a lot of people, they love to say that they like to wait for the last minute, and they do. I mean, we saw in, you know, the famous time in 2004 when Dick Gephardt and Howard Dean were beating each other over the head, and they had the lead, a big lead in the Iowa caucuses with 2 weeks to go because they were fighting each other. The winner was John Kerry, followed by John Edwards. And, you know, Gephardt and Dean have never been heard from since. So you know, a lot of these states really do take their role in the process very seriously, and they make their minds up late in the process.
Well, Ken, you know, we've talked about this national polling and how the state polling matters. Trump was found liable earlier this month in that civil case for sexually abusing and defaming former magazine columnist E. Jean Carroll. He was indicted earlier this spring in a separate criminal case related to hush money payments to Stormy Daniels. We need to note, of course, that the former president has denied all wrongdoing. But do you think any of this can touch him? I mean, or affect his popularity? It doesn't seem to be so far.
You know, before the indictment, there were a lot of polls that showed DeSantis gaining, that he was the guy who was going to take down Donald Trump. And once the indictments came, Trump's numbers shot up. And I guess this is part of the cult following he has that feels that if the establishment or whatever it is taking, you know, going to attack Donald Trump, well, I'm going to defend him. I'm going to stand up for him. And that's remarkable. Usually when you think, I mean, I still think of Rick Perry, who in 2012, because he couldn't think of the third government agency he would cut, his campaign was a joke. And Trump says things that would doom any candidate, let alone be indicted, the first former president ever indicted. And yet his numbers stay solid, if not increasing. So, again, we do have the debate starting in August, although Trump says he's not going to be part of the first debate. And why should he be? I mean, you know, nobody's going to, even if he's accused of ducking the debates, he has a big lead. And why should he let the other candidates have any attention? So he seems to be knowing what he's doing. But as we said, there are much more important, more substantive indictments, perhaps in the future, coming from Atlanta and the Department of Justice.
David, do you think any of the other Republicans running in the primary at this point will take on the former president in a big way? I mean, considering how popular he continues to be with his base, and he really does have a way of skewering his opposition when he feels like people are coming after him.
Well, you're certainly right about that. And I think this is one of the signature struggles that we're seeing already DeSantis go through, that we saw all of his opponents in 2016 go through. Do you kind of wink and nod and try and, you know, keep doing what you do, or do you take him on head on? And I think, you know, he's a slippery opponent because, as you know, you and Ken were just referencing, the normal liabilities, the things that would be disqualifying, don't seem to apply. You can't run against him on ethics because nobody thinks of him as ethical. You can't run on him, as you know, as Ken just referenced that Governor Perry example. You can't run on him on not knowing the details, because nobody thinks he knows the details. So, you know, it's a really difficult struggle. And I think you see DeSantis dipping his toe into electability, that Trump can't win. And, you know, it is fascinating to think about where the end point is for Republican supporters of Trump, you know, when you consider the losses the party incurred in 2018, the losses the party incurred in 2020, the losses incurred in 2022. But of course, the Trump answer for that, you know, is the magical thinking of, well, they weren't really losses. So it gets very circular for his opponents, and he has proven to be a very slippery opponent to deal with.
Well, that's the tricky thing. I mean, I would imagine, I obviously am not running for president, although people beg me all the time. But
you have any buttons?
I don't, but I mean, I could get some. But it seems to me, if you are running against Trump, if you're a Ron DeSantis and you're dipping your toe into this electability question, a lot of Trump's supporters think he did win in 2020, right? That he did get elected.
And that's the circular madness of this whole thing. And, you know, in a normal campaign, and I've worked in campaigns at every level, in a normal campaign, you identify an opposing candidate's liabilities and you try and make that liability stand in for the whole of the person. And you apply that to Trump and it does you absolutely no good. The liabilities are already baked in and somehow been transformed into assets. So it is a real challenge. And here's really where it gets hard for somebody like DeSantis. Okay, so going head to head, attacking Trump is a difficult task. Well, how about you beat him on sort of just basic sort of charm and desirability as a candidate? DeSantis is kind of boring. Most of these folks can't step up and do, you know, the things that Trump does for a crowd. And that's perhaps an even more fundamental challenge they're going to face.
He's more than just boring. I mean, he's humorless and he's he really is.
Yeah, no.
He lectures us all. He's thin-skinned. It'll be fascinating. I mean, you know, the fact is that, you know, unlike Tim Scott, who announced his candidacy on Monday in a gymnasium filled with, you know, raucous supporters, DeSantis will be out of public view tonight. You know, he'll just be on Twitter, audio only. So,
right.
I don't know.
Announcing his presidential candidacy in a sensory deprivation chamber.
Exactly.
Well, okay. On that note, we do have some callers waiting. Before we take them, Ken, can you repeat this month's trivia question for us?
Well, in the possible talk of dumping Kamala Harris as Joe Biden's vice president, who was the last president who dumped his elected vice president? Who was the president, and what was the year?
Okay, if you think you have the answer, this is your chance. Give us a call at 513-419-7100. Tim, thank you so much for calling. What is your trivia guess?
Franklin Roosevelt dumping Henry Wallace in 1944 for Harry Truman.
That is the correct answer. Harry Truman, matter of fact, Henry Wallace was very liberal. He thought it was, as he turned out when he ran for president in 1948, he was said to be pro-Soviet Union. So it was very interesting that FDR, we didn't know he was dying at the time, but he dumped Henry Wallace as his running mate in 1944, and the convention picked some senator from Missouri named Harry Truman, who became president, you know, 3 or 4 months after the inauguration.
And the buck stopped there, huh?
It did.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Tim. If you could please hold, one of our producers will be talking with you.
Thank you.
On the first answer, boy, that was disappointing. Or good. Sort of my tricks on people.
Yeah. Well, we thought you had two, but
you know, the second one after him would probably be Doug Burgum. You know, if he makes the ticket.
And which Dakota is he governor of again? I kind of lost track.
It's a Dakota ring that you get into the cereal. Yeah.
But bump. Okay, he's here all hour, ladies and germs. Tip your wait staff, Ken Rudin. Okay, Ken, I wanted to ask you, too. The former President Trump, enjoys lots of support from current Republican office holders, too. How important is that?
Are you asking me that?
Yes, I am asking you that, Ken.
Well, I don't think it matters. I mean, you know, I think Ron DeSantis doesn't have any member of the Senate, but he has a lot of his state legislators around the country. He has a lot in Iowa. But I still think, you know, I remember Howard Dean in Iowa. He had the backing of Al Gore. He had the backing of Tom Harkin. And he wound up finishing third or fourth in Iowa. Mm-hmm. So endorsements don't really mean something. And even in midterm elections, when you think of Ronald Reagan, how popular he was in 1980 and 1984, but in 1982, he campaigned for a lot of candidates, you know, with endorsements, and it didn't help them at all. So I think unless they're actually on the ballot themselves, endorsements are overrated.
Okay. Well, and we referenced this earlier, David, but Senator Tim Scott, you know, at least in his kickoff, seemed to be pushing a more positive, kind of idealistic message. How do you think that will work or not work for him in today's political climate?
Well, you do have to ask the question, what would be the point of sounding just like everybody else? And, you know, the typical Republican candidate, you know, has kind of an apocalyptic tone to them. And, you know, it's always we're under siege and it's always, you know, this disaster is looming. So, you know, I credit him for offering something distinct, coming at this from a different angle. You know, of course, the question then is there an audience for that in the Republican Party? I mean, you know, obviously a big part of this, you know, reality for Republicans is their audience is listening to Fox News. Their audience is keened on the latest grievance. And so, can you run on, you know, what used to be, I mean, you know, we've already mentioned Reagan a couple of times, what used to be sort of the you know, the basic premise that Republicans could offer, you know, some alternative, some, you know, sunny alternative. Now, of course, there was also, you know, the Soviets are out to get us and we're going, you know, we're in great danger in one side, but there was, you know, it was coupled with a positive, you know, a positive aspect to it that you don't see a lot of when most Republicans are speaking.
Okay. We have a caller on the line. Frank, thank you so much for calling. What is your question or comment?
Yeah. First, I want to comment. Didn't Roosevelt dump Vice President Garner from Texas in 40? Or did Garner leave on the time?
Actually, what happened is Garner was elected two terms. He was the Speaker of the House. He was elected with Roosevelt in 32 and 36. In 1940, Garner challenged Roosevelt for the nomination. He didn't want to be vice president anymore. He wanted to be president, you know, stopping the third term, which never happened before. So he basically talked himself off the ticket. He wasn't dumped. He decided to run for president instead.
Mm.
Okay. All right. Well, my question is, can Congress legislate any type of ethics for the Supreme Court, or are we stuck with the most corrupt justice in Supreme Court history and Clarence Thomas and his wacko wife?
Thank you for that question, Frank. What do you think, Ken? There's been an awful lot of talk about Congress kind of dipping their toes into this.
Well, apparently the separation of powers is what everybody, including Chief Justice
Roberts,
Roberts has called for. So I think if there's any, I mean, you know, the guy, the billionaire, Republican billionaire who's paid for all the vacations and rentals and all
that. Harlan Crow.
Yeah, Harlan Crow for Clarence Thomas. He says, I'm not going to reveal any of my information. It's none of your business, and it's not Congress's business. They have no say. So it may be up to John Roberts if there's going to be any kind of ethics involved, ethics bills or guidelines involved. It may, you know, it's going to have to come from the court itself. Now, the court recently said, you know, they kind of nodded and say, yeah, we should have improved ethics. But my goodness, you think of what happened to Abe Fortas in 1969 when he was forced to resign because of shady business deals. What Clarence Thomas has done just, you know, clobbers Fortas's misdeeds by a lot. But I mean, who's going to force him out? Not the conservative majority on the court. So, and you can't, you know, you could try to recall him or impeach him, like Gerald Ford tried to impeach Justice Douglas in 1970. Of course, that went nowhere. it's going to go nowhere, and it's going to hopefully Roberts will take this seriously, as he appears to be doing, and might come up with some new ethics guidelines.
Thanks for your call, Frank, and thanks so much for that question. So one more question along these lines about this presidential race, and then we will take a break and move on with our lives. But a Washington Post analysis earlier this month noted that Republicans haven't had big electoral wins overall since the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade. What do you think, Ken? What do you think are the issues that are going to get people to the polls and really determine how they vote?
Well, look at what happened in 2022. By all historical precedents, that the Democrats should have taken a beating. But what Joe Biden and the Democrats decided to do was make it almost a referendum on one, the right to choose, you know, the Roe decision, and two, threats to democracy, as Donald Trump showed that he was willing to upend the 2020 election results for his benefit. So it's issues like that. I mean, of course, if it's about Joe Biden, Biden loses. And Biden likes to say if it's about Trump, Trump loses. But one, there's no guarantee it'll be Trump. Two, I mean, Trump could be in prison, although I doubt that. But the fact is that what worked for the Democrats in 2022, Democrats feel that will work again in 2024. And that is issues like abortion, guns, and the threat to democracy.
Well, we will continue with our full hour of politics in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition. You can support WVXU right now by calling 513-419-7155, or you can give online at WVXU.org. Today's your chance to do something that will make you feel really good by giving to the radio station that helps you get through the day. You can become a sustaining member at WVXU.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. It's our full hour of politics with political journalist and host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin, and University of Cincinnati School of Public and International Affairs Associate Professor of Political Science, David Niven, Ph.D. We're going to talk about the debt ceiling, but Ken, I understand you have some additional thoughts about Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas that you wanted to add.
Well, as we were just talking about it, as soon as we went to the break, I got a text that says, "Stand with Clarence Thomas. The woke mob has exploded. They're in a rabid frenzy against the greatest Supreme Court justice in American history. And just now, a petition to have him impeached has been signed by over 1.2 million radical Democrat activists. We need an overwhelming response immediately, or we'll lose Clarence Thomas forever. You stand with him, yes. You know, I'm a woke Democrat. We need 100,000 responses before the end of the day for us to succeed. Please answer now, and please, we're seconds away from losing Clarence Thomas."
Wow.
So I figured our show has a bigger, clout than I expected.
No, that's kidding. Great. People are really listening. Thanks for tuning in, friends. We appreciate that. We had a note from Kathy in Oxford, and she emailed to write, "What most people don't seem to understand is this one." Oh, okay. You know what? Kathy's talking about something we're going to talk about later in the show. Kathy, hold on. We're going to get to you. I apologize. I was reading while I was, I should have read ahead there. But first, before we get to your question, Kathy, let's talk about the debt ceiling. I don't want to talk about it too much because I know everybody's heard a whole lot about it. Ken, we've been hearing about the debt ceiling for months now. What do you think the chances are that the U.S. will actually default on its debt? Are chances greater this time than in the past? It seems like we've been through this time and time again.
I think this is exactly what people hate about politics, because we all do the henny-penny, the world is falling, we're at the precipice of a collapse, and then somehow, lo and behold, a deal is made. But in answer to what you just said at the end of your question, yes, we are closer than ever before, because there are members of Congress, especially the radical right members of the House Freedom Caucus, who say they refuse to do it unless there's draconian cuts in spending. Now, first of all, nobody's going to cut spending on defense situation, given the fact that what's going on in Ukraine, and given the possibility of a China China-Taiwan explosion. So, and Joe Biden is not going to, let alone what the left wing is upset about, but Joe Biden is not going to allow cuts in education and transportation and infrastructure and meals and things like that. So they're meeting, you know, they sat down Monday for the first time in weeks. The deadline probably is June 1st, although some Republicans say, well, on June 15th, you know, corporations will pay their taxes, their quarterly taxes, and we'll have a lot more money. But a lot of people think that the stock market collapse, default can go on just around June 1st. So I'm pretty much convinced that here we go again, and it's going to be resolved, even maybe only in the short term. But again, this, we've gone through this over and over and over again. It's going to be the end of the world. It's going to be the end of everything. Joe Biden's at fault. And then suddenly they come to a deal at the end. And of course, nobody will be happy with the end result.
David, so how much of this do you think is political theater?
Almost all of it is political theater. I mean, that's, as you know, Ken just said, why do people find politics so frustrating and, you know, so infuriating? You know, this is a game, and you know, the Republicans, I mean, I think best encapsulated, you know, Representative Matt Gaetz from Florida literally said that he doesn't understand why he and the Republicans, why are we negotiating with the hostage? And the hostage, wow, in this case being, you know, the president and the country and the economy. And, you know, I think that really just typifies what this is. You know, this is not about sincere differences. You know, this is not about, you know, leadership. You know, this is a political game, and it's one that, you know, we keep seeing, and it only, you know, the only way, you know, these participants can feel like they win is to push harder and harder and harder in each round. And, you know, I think the ultimate bottom line is if House Republicans actually tried to take the whole thing down, the president would have to maneuver around them. But he's trying to do everything he can to avoid having to take that step. Let me just throw in one other side issue, which is there's no guarantee that the House Republican caucus is going to remain united. It only takes a few, let's say, level-headed types to shift the entire conversation, because the House Republican majority is not very large.
Well, right. If five Republicans vote with all the Democrats, Joe Biden's side wins, although I don't know if wins is the right word.
Ken, there are plenty of politicians and economists who are saying, you know, as you said, a default would have big ramifications for the U.S. economy and possibly the world economy. Has this just become a political game of chicken? It doesn't seem like economic devastation would be good politically for anybody.
Well, that's exactly right. And I mean, as David just said, that it is a game. It is a you know, a game of gamesmanship. And the fact is that, you know, given the fact that Kevin McCarthy sold his soul to become Speaker, and Matt Gaetz has more say in some of these things than Speaker himself, he's in a bind. And I don't feel bad for McCarthy, because he could have stood up and become, you know, been more of a leader rather than a follower. But he knows that, and as Matt Gaetz has pointed out, that, you know, that McCarthy has agreed to the rule that one member of the caucus can demand a new vote on the Speaker. And if Kevin McCarthy disappoints his, you know, House Freedom Caucus people enough, he could be deposed as Speaker, just as John Boehner and Ryan was. Hmm. Or
so. David, you know, you mentioned, you kind of referenced that the president could try these other measures to work around Congress. We won't get into all the 14th Amendment details and all. There are so many different strategies that we've all heard about and read about. Have you heard any meaningful talk about what should or could be changed to make sure the nation doesn't face this again and again and again and again?
Well, you certainly could change, you know, the law so as to not require these constant, you know, adjustments, and to just certify that we're going to recognize our own debt and not allow this game to be played. And it's kind of one of those things where if you planned ahead enough, you know, this would be, like, you know, the ultimate, you know, in terms of, you know, making sure you pack provisions for the long winter ahead. If you planned enough ahead, Democrats could have worked on this when they had, you know, majorities in the House and the Senate and the presidency. But it's never pressing when it isn't pressing. And that's how we wind up in this problem where it recurs, each time a Democrat's in the White House and Republicans have part of Congress.
And remember when Donald Trump was president, three times they raised the debt limit and the Democrats didn't cause a fuss or play games or make threats. It's only when it seems like only when there's a Democrat in the White House do Republicans suddenly realize that fiscal responsibility is a serious issue.
Yes, they suddenly become aware of this debt and they're really deeply troubled by it for a short period of time.
Do you agree that it's going to be a short-term extension and that's probably what's going to come of it?
I think that's probably the most likely outcome just because nobody is confident they would benefit from doing otherwise.
You know, if we keep talking, Lucy will not have to stay for the rest of the show.
And at that, we'll continue our full hour of politics just ahead. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're back with our full hour of politics with political journalist and host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin, and University of Cincinnati School of Public and International Affairs Associate Professor of Political Science, David Niven, PhD. You can join the conversation and share your perspective by calling 513-419-7100 or emailing talk@wvxu.org. David, I want to talk about this very important issue that Kathy in Oxford wrote to us about, and that is this constitutional change in Ohio that, if approved, would make it more difficult to amend the Constitution. Give us your take on this, David.
Well, this is really a critical maneuver on the part of state legislative Republicans in Ohio. They are afraid that there is a majority in Ohio that supports abortion rights. And they are afraid that because that majority exists, that their ability to choose policies on the issue will be compromised. So what they came up with is an end run around folks, which is a constitutional amendment. It's on the ballot in August in Ohio that would raise the threshold for future constitutional amendments from a simple majority to a 60% requirement. So if this passes, any constitutional amendment that were to get, say, 59.99% support would fail. It would have to get 60% to succeed. And this is meant as an end run around a potential future reproductive rights question that might appear on the ballot in November. So if this passes, then that question would have to get 60% support to pass. And one really important thing about this constitutional amendment that would raise the standard for future amendments to 60% is this amendment would pass with a simple majority. So half of Ohioans who show up and vote in August could well take the power away from future Ohio majorities to change the state constitution.
Well, and this is what Kathy in Oxford was writing to us about. She writes, "What most people don't seem to understand is that this issue 1 on the August 8th ballot not only raises the threshold for number of votes needed to pass a ballot initiative to 60% plus 1, but in the future that signatures will be required for 88 counties instead of the current 44. And this is the big thing that people don't understand, that 5% of all registered voters must sign the petition to get a resolution on the ballot, as opposed to the current threshold of 5% of all voters in the last gubernatorial election." David, what do you think about that? Do you think a lot of people are confused about the extent of the changes this could make?
Well, certainly that's right to say this ballot initiative makes it harder. It makes it harder comprehensively. So the headline is raising the standard from a majority to 60%. But it's true that the signature gathering process to put a constitutional amendment on the ballot in front of voters in the future would go up. And without getting too deep into the weeds here, you know, it's simply meant to thwart ideas. I mean, for example, one of the details is right now, if you submit a constitutional amendment and you're short of the total required signatures to get it on the ballot, you're given a 1-week grace period because it's very hard to know as you're gathering signatures how many are going to prove to be valid. So if you turn them in and Ohio says you're short, you have 1 week to make it up. This amendment would eliminate that week for no reason, for no, you know, for no logical reason, but to thwart more future amendments. And so, you know, let's understand the fundamentals here. You know, Republicans in Ohio have massive majorities. They have super majorities. They can do anything they want in the legislature, and they're trying to lock in the state constitution as it exists now. I mean, they you know, we've got what we want in there, and now we're going to just put this whole thing to bed. And that's the nature of this proposal, comprehensively making it harder for any future amendment to make the ballot. And if it makes the ballot, for it to be passed and enshrined into the Constitution.
Well, David, I know the Ohio Supreme Court is considering a lawsuit over whether the resolution to put this measure on the ballot was legal. What do you think will come of that?
Well, there's actually two lawsuits now. So one is about the fact that this election is taking place in August. And what's really significant about that question is the Republicans in the state legislature in Ohio banned August elections just 6 months ago. So they literally removed August elections because, as their leadership pointed out, very few people vote in August. So there's no such thing as an August election. So they had to sort of improvise one for the purposes of this ballot question. And that's because of the timing. If they don't get this question on the ballot before reproductive rights, then it doesn't do them any good. It doesn't make it harder to pass a reproductive rights amendment. And in fact, it would be a threat to them, because if it's not before reproductive rights, if this amendment and reproductive rights were both to pass, it would then get harder to take reproductive rights out of the Ohio Constitution. So they don't want that. So two challenges to this. One is there's no such thing as an August election. The legislature effectively, you know, winked and nodded its way to let's have a vote in August. The second challenge is the language of the question doesn't say that the standard right now is a simple majority. So people are going to see this ballot question and see 60%, but they're not going to know, well, what's the standard now? And what scope of change am I really making here? So that's a second challenge. The Ohio Supreme Court is, of course, a Republican majority and has generally been rather sympathetic to the actions of the legislature. So it really will be a question of whether this is sort of a straight law analysis or if this is a straight politics analysis. And that will tell us if this vote is going to be allowed to happen and if this language is going to be maintained.
We got another email. This one is from Bob. Bob emails, I have heard that the elections boards, do not have the personnel and ballots to handle the August election. They're estimating that there will be 30% of voters will turn out to vote and the elections boards can't handle it. What have you heard about that, David?
Well, that's absolutely true. The across Ohio, election boards pleaded with the legislature not to put this election in August because it means every single thing that they do for November in terms of securing polling places, securing poll workers, going through the process of absentee ballots and setting up the entire operation has to be duplicated in August when A, they don't have the personnel, B, they don't have, the physical location secured. See, they have to improvise and do this on a calendar that's constrained. I mean, they plan for a November election all year, whereas 2 weeks ago, they didn't even know they were going to have an August election. So there are certainly boards of elections across Ohio that are in, you know, crisis mode right now, trying to deal with these challenges. And that's really one of the central aspects of this story. You know, we're used to voting. We have a November election and we all know about that. And we're used to having, you know, an annual primary, that sort of thing. We're not used to voting in August. You know, the state of Ohio has had two August statewide elections, you know, since 1940. And the turnout has been atrocious and the cost has been enormous because you essentially have to replicate everything you would otherwise be doing in November.
Well, let's turn from pleading in Ohio to pleading on Capitol Hill. Ken, there have been lots and lots of headlines about Senator Dianne Feinstein, her health, her absence from the U.S. Senate, her return. Tell us why this has been so important for the Democratic Party.
Well, it is because basically she is the senior Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. Right now, there are 11, because the Democrats nominally control the Senate. There are 11 Democrats on the Judiciary Committee, 10 Republicans. When she left in February, and when she was sick for 3 months, apparently she didn't even tell us what was wrong. It turned out to be shingles and perhaps encephalitis. So, her health was much worse than people knew. But the fact is that because it was a 10-10 tie on judiciary, many of President Biden's judicial nominees, all of them actually, couldn't be acted on because there was no Democratic majority of the 10-10 tie. So there are a lot of people who said, well, you know, she should resign her seat. And mostly Democrats, like what they did with Ruth Bader Ginsburg. They said Dianne Feinstein had a great career, an illustrious career, but it's time for her to resign. Let Democrat Governor Gavin Newsom pick a replacement. But here's the thing. When there's a vacancy on a Senate committee, basically 60 votes have to be in favor of allowing that replacement. In other words, if one Republican objected to a replacement on the committee, adding a Democrat, that person could demand a vote, and they would need 60 votes to okay that additional Democrat. Now, as Mitt Romney said, he said, look, I'm not going to vote. I'm not going to vote to allow a left-wing judge, justice, to be added to the courts. So Republicans are not going to go along with it. Basically, you'd have to have 10 Republicans to vote with all the Democrats to allow a Democratic replacement. And that's not going to happen. So the best thing, the only thing really that could happen that would benefit President Biden and the Democrats, and especially if there was a vacancy on the Supreme Court, not that anyone was expecting one anytime soon, but they desperately need Dianne Feinstein to stay on the Judiciary Committee because they need her vote. Now, is she aware of things? Is she smart? Is she cognizant of what's going on? That's questionable because a lot of her answers to questions have been really very fuzzy and almost heartbreaking. There was a case of Carl Mundt, the senator from South Dakota, who suffered a stroke in 1969, never showed up again in the Senate. And, you know, and then he, you know, then there was a new election 3 years later in 1972. But back then it was an overwhelming Democratic majority in the Senate. This time the vote is so crucial that Democrats who are calling on her to resign and leave the Senate are making a terrible mistake on their behalf because they need her vote desperately, and a replacement is unlikely to be confirmed by the full Senate.
Gotcha. So I understand what you're saying. You're saying, okay, if Dianne Feinstein did resign, Gavin Newsom appointed a Democrat to take her place, that doesn't guarantee that Democrat would get that spot on the Judiciary Committee because any Democrat.
When Feinstein was gone for 3 or 4 months, Chuck Schumer, the Senate Majority Leader, tried to get Ben Cardin of Maryland as a temporary replacement on the committee, and the Republicans said absolutely not. And they didn't even bring it up for a vote because Schumer knew he couldn't win it. And that would be the same thing even if Gavin Newsom named a replacement for Senator Feinstein. You know, it's funny. She's 89 years old, and everybody's saying she's too old. Joe Biden is 80 years old, and everybody's saying he's too old. But the Republicans who are campaigning in Iowa are begging for the endorsement from Chuck Grassley, who's 89 years old. So I guess old Democrats are useless, but old Republicans, God bless, right?
Well, and I wanted to ask you just quickly, you know, you mentioned her age, there are male senators who continue to serve much longer than that. Senator Robert Byrd was 92 plus and served in the Senate. Strom Thurmond was 100. Some allies of Dianne Feinstein have said sexism is playing a role in all this. What do you think? Is that a fair criticism, or is she just really so sick that that's why people are saying she's out of it, she needs to go?
I really think it's because of the margin of the Senate is just so airtight that, you know, had the Democrats picked up a seat, for example, had the Republicans picked up one seat in the Senate in 2022, the Republicans would have controlled the Senate. So it's really the fact that the margin is so narrow. I mean, they were talking about Strom Thurmond. They were basically wheeling him in. He died at the age of 100, and I think he resigned. You know, his term was up only a year or so before that happened. But again, the margins in the Senate weren't that crucial. But Thurmond was just basically wheeled in. He raised his hand, and they wheeled him out again. And even if that's the case with Dianne Feinstein, her vote is far more crucial than any previous instance with Byrd or Thurmond or anybody like that.
Just because of how tight it is in the Senate.
Especially with judicial nominations. Because a lot of people predict, including me, that the Republicans are going to win the Senate in 2024. There are far more vulnerable Democratic seats up than Republicans. And so Biden and Schumer have got to get as much done this year and next, because after 2024, it may be too late.
Okay, so huge implications for the nation's Democrats with this one senator from California. It'll be interesting to see how this all plays out. I have been talking with political journalist and host of the Political Junkie podcast, Ken Rudin, and University of Cincinnati School of Public and International Affairs Associate Professor of Political Science, David Niven, PhD. Thank you both so much for your time today.
It's always a pleasure.
Two words, Doug Burgum. Don't forget.
You heard it here first, ladies and germs. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director today is Ella Rowan. If you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thank you so much for listening.